good day. This is Mary reading for the Talking Information Centre, and I'm reading from The Week. And first story up here, it is March. No, it's not March, it's April. April 6th of 2026. All right, so the Senate debates the GOP voter ID bill. The Senate opened debate last week on a Republican bill that would impose strict voter ID rules in federal elections, legislation that President Trump called his number one priority, but stands almost no chance of approval in the closely divided chamber. The Senate voted 51 to 48 to launch what will likely be a marathon debate session on the SAVE Act. The legislation would require showing proof of citizenship via a passport, certified birth certificate, or an enhanced driver's license offered in only 5 border states before registering and voting. It would also require states to regularly send voter rolls to the Department of Homeland Security. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed Democrats will never let this rotten bill move through. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican Alaska, rejected the debate measure, and some Republicans are questioning Trump's demand to add a near-total ban on mail-in voting, with support likely below the 60-vote threshold needed to avoid a filibuster. Majority Leader John Thune warned he can't guarantee an outcome. Some supporters have suggested abolishing the filibuster, a move Thune and other Senate Republicans ferociously opposed when Democrats controlled the chamber. Senator Mike Lee, Republican Utah, suggested forcing Democrats into a talking filibuster or holding the floor in a round-the-clock debate. Trump declared he would not sign any other legislation until the SAVE Act was passed, writing on True Social that only sick, demented, or deranged people could oppose it. Spending this much time on a hopeless bill isn't typically how the Senate operates, said Jordan Carney in Politico. But Republicans face intense pressure from the White House to prove that they are fighting for election integrity. Democrats, however, say there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud, and note that there are more than 21 million Americans lack immediate access to the documents the SAVE Act requires, including married women who changed their last names. This is legislation that most Americans want, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. The SAVE Act has 71% support among voters. Polling from late 2025 showed 83% Americans approved of requiring a government-issued photo ID to vote. But the real goal of the SAVE Act isn't about simple voter ID, said Jamal Bowie in the New York Times. It's a disfranchising Trump's opponent. It's disenfranchising Trump's opponents. If that sounds exaggerated, you need only to read what the president says about the bill, that it would guarantee the midterms for the GOP and ensure Democrats probably won't win an election for 50 years. Democrats would quietly celebrate nuking the filibuster, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. They wanted this bulwark against extremism gone for years. If the 60-vote threshold is abolished, Democrats next time could make new states out of Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, or even add justices to the Supreme Court. The SAVE Act isn't worth that risk. And also from the week, it's not easy to topple a $30 trillion economy, said Alice Wallace in CNN.com. But if the war in Iran keeps driving fuel prices higher, things will soon start getting dodgy for America. With Iran's blockade of the Straits of Hormuz, stopping the export of oil from many Gulf Arab states, and missiles and drones raining down on oil and natural gas facilities across the Middle East. The International Energy Agency warned last week that the world is facing the biggest energy crisis in history. The U.S. is already feeling the shockwaves. Oil has rocketed by roughly 30% to about $100 a barrel. Gasoline has hit a national average of $3.98 a gallon, up by a dollar since February, and is over $5 in California, Washington, and Hawaii. Understandably, some 45% of Americans say that they are extremely or very concerned about gas prices, according to an Associated Press poll. For a first glimpse of where we may be headed, look at Asia, said Alexander Stevenson in the New York Times. In a region that relies on Middle Eastern energy, gas stations in Thailand and Vietnam are posting sold-out signs. People in India are hoarding cooking gas. Asian airlines have cancelled thousands of flights after the price of jet fuel more than doubled. And all this after only 1 month of a conflict, with no clear end in sight. The war is also driving the world toward a food crisis, said Heather Stewart in The Guardian. Hormuz is a key choke point in the global supply of urea, a nitrogen-based fertilizer that's made using natural gas and sulfur, and a byproduct of oil and gas refining and other critical fertilizer ingredients. Once farmers get hit by the double whammy of higher energy bills and more costly fertilizer, it could push some 45 million people around the planet into acute hunger, according to a UN estimate. Americans won't starve, said Max Xan at ABCNews.com, but they will pay more for everything, from groceries to smartphones. A third of the world's helium travels through the strait. That gas is essential for the production of microchips used in phones, AI servers, and almost all electronics. The chaos in the Middle East is also pushing up the cost of plastics, which are made of petrochemicals and aluminium, because the region is home to several key smelters. There is some good news for Americans, said John Casty in The New Yorker. Thanks to decades of tightened emission standards, so detested by President Trump, our economy is far less energy intensive than it used to be. With every dollar of GDP created requiring one half of the energy it needed back in 1980. As long as the war ends soon, many economists think the U.S. can probably scrape through this year without a recession. It's already too late, said The Economist in an editorial. Even if fighting stopped today, it would take at least 4 months for oil facilities in the Middle East to restart production and process backlog crude into usable fuel, and for markets and prices to regain some semblance of a normality. And that's a best-case scenario, said Roger Kama in The Atlantic. If fighting escalates instead, Iran could reach for the doomsday option it previewed last week when it responded to an Israeli strike on its largest natural gas field by attacking a Qatari facility that produces 20% of the world's supply of liquefied natural gas, causing natural gas prices to spike 35% in Europe. If there are more such attacks on energy infrastructure in the target-rich Middle East, our current energy crisis may become a global economic catastrophe that we'll be living with for years. And also from the week, the world at a glance. And in London, anti-Semitic attack. Vandals torched four ambulances outside a Jewish charity in London this week in what Prime Minister Keir Starmer called a deeply shocking anti-Semitic arson attack. Nobody was injured. The ambulances were parked near a synagogue and operated by Hatzolah. which provides EMT services in the largely Jewish neighborhood of Golders Green. Harakat Ashab al-Jamin al-Islamiya, a newly emerged group linked to Iran, claim responsibility for the attack, as it has for similar anti-Semitic attacks this month in Belgium, the Netherlands, and France. A Golders Green resident told the London Times that people fled their homes as oxygen tanks in the vehicles exploded, sounding like bombs going off. And then from Paris, socialists prevail for now. The left won local elections in France's biggest cities this week, but the far right made gains in many smaller cities. Socialists held on to the mayorships of Paris, Marseille, and Lille. This message is clear. Paris is not and never will be a far-right city. Paris mayor-elect Emmanuel Grégory said after winning with a boost from Greens and Communists. The far-left party, France Unbowed, also did well, especially in working-class Paris suburbs. But Eurosceptic anti-immigration national rally, which leads presidential polls, won in 30 smaller towns as it continued to build grassroots support. And it scored an under-president win in Nice, France's fifth largest city. And in Bogota, Colombia. Colombia denied this week that President Gustavo Petro has any link to drug traffickers, after reports suggested the U.S. had opened a federal investigation probing alleged ties. The New York Times reported that at least two U.S. attorneys' offices in New York were looking into whether Petro met with any traffickers and whether his campaign requested illegal donations. Petro, Colombia's first left-wing leader, has been an outspoken critic of the U.S. military's attacks on Venezuelan boats and its ousting of former Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. He has an uncertain relationship with President Trump, who first called him a sick man who helped funnel Colombian cocaine to the U.S., and then after a White House meeting called him terrific. Petro said he has never in my life spoken with a drug trafficker. And then from Budapest, there's a Russian plot. Russian intelligence agents discuss staging a phony assassination attempt against Kremlin-friendly Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban to stir up sympathy for him ahead of next month's election. The Washington Post reported this week, in an intercepted communication, Russian agents called their plan the Game Changer, saying it would change the subject from Hungary's crumbling economy to security. Polls show Orban trailing Peter Magyar, a pro-Europe, anti-corruption opposition leader. The Kremlin is doing everything it can to support Orban, who has been its champion in the EU, blocking sanctions and the Ukrainian aid. Orban's foreign minister, Peter Zajato, regularly telephones his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, with the live reports from EU meetings, one European security official said. So every such gathering for years was basically had Moscow behind the table. And also from the World at a Glance. And now we'll go to Moscow. Spring Offensive. Russia unleashed one of its largest aerial attacks of the war against Ukraine this week, hitting Kiev and other cities with more than 1,000 drones. Ground forces also began a spring offensive in the east. Ukraine escalated too, launching its largest drone wave yet into Russia, and Russia-occupied Crimea. The Kremlin has cut off cell service in much of Moscow, ostensibly to foil the Ukrainian drones, but Odyeya Tenshinova, an independent Russian exile news site based in Europe reported last week that the shuttle was actually aimed at protecting Vladimir Putin. The Russian president has stopped going to the Kremlin and cancelled all public engagements as a security precaution. He is said to be spooked by the reports that Israel targeted and killed Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei by hacking traffic cameras and tracking his bodyguards. And in Tokyo, don't mention the war, Japanese Prime Minister Zani Takachi got mixed reviews at home after sitting silently through President Trump's awkward joke about World War II during her visit to the Oval Office last week. When a Japanese reporter asked why Trump didn't warn allies before attacking Iran, Trump said, "We wanted surprise. Who knows better about surprise than Japan, okay? Why didn't you tell me about Pearl Harbor?" Chucky's eyes widened. But she said nothing. Earlier, she had told Trump that only he could achieve peace across the world. Former diplomat Hitoshi Tanaka said both incidents showed subservience that was bizarre and embarrassing. But supporters praised Takichi for keeping her cool. The newspaper Nikkan Gedani said Trump had confronted Japan with the reality that the relationship is not one of equality and that the U.S. holds the upper hand. And also from the week, once derided as Little Marco, Trump's 2016 primary rival is now a power player in his administration. And how influential is Rubio? As the first official since Henry Kissinger to serve as both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, the 54-year-old former senator is now the most powerful foreign policy voice in the White House in decades. An executor of President Trump's America First doctrine, he has presided over the dismantling of the U.S. Agency of International Development, fired hundreds of foreign service officers, and revoked more than 80,000 visas, many belonging to foreign students in the U.S. who criticized Israel's war in Gaza. He played a key role in planning the January raid that captured Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro, and later tasked by Trump with helping to run the country. Rubio's mega ascendance is in many ways unlikely. Battling Trump for the Republican presidential nominee in 2016, Rubio savaged his current boss as a con artist and made insinuations about Trump's manhood by referencing his small hands. A skilled political operator, the man Trump once dismissively nicknamed Little Marco, has since integrated himself with Trump, who regularly lauds him in public. "When I have a problem, I call up Marco," Trump said in May. "He gets it solved." He was born in Miami to Cuban immigrants, whom he for years described as exiles, suggesting they arrived in the U.S. after Fidel Castro seized power in 1959. In 2011, multiple outlets uncovered records showing his father, a bartender, and mother, a hotel maid, arrived in the U.S. 3 years before the Castro-led revolution. Still, his family's immigrant story and staunch anti-communist beliefs became a key theme in his political career. Elected as a city commissioner in West Miami in 1998, the University of Miami Law School graduate won a seat in the Florida House 2 years later. Rubio impressed GOP colleagues with his drive and became the chamber's first Cuban-American speaker in 2006, elected to the U.S. Senate on a Tea Party platform in 2010. He focused on national security while running for president. He vowed to spread economic and political freedom, bolster alliances, and resist despots who subjected their smaller neighbours. He ended his presidential campaign in 2016 after Trump crushed him in the Florida primary. And how did he become... Trump ally? When Trump retreated to Mar-a-Lago following his 2020 defeat, then Senator Rubio began building bridges with his former foe. The pair spoke regularly on the phone. And as Trump's prosecutions and scandals mounted, Rubio went out of his way never to criticize the president publicly, said one Rubio associate. When Trump ran for president again in 2024, Rubio gave an early endorsement and began wooing Trump's children. Since becoming Secretary of State, he has finally defended the president's policies and lauded his boss. Trump is standing up for America in a way that no president has ever had the courage to do before, Rubio wrote on X, after Trump lashed out at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in an explosive 2025 White House meeting. The administration is a sneak pit, but Rubio just seemed to be a little bit better at navigating it, a former administration official told Politico. He's also proved remarkably malleable in adapting his views to the MAGA agenda. And how has he changed? Having demanded in 2022 that President Joe Biden's boost funding for U.S. aid to counter the China's rising global influence, Rubio last year oversaw its dismantling, calling it an agency that long ago went off the rails. A one-time champion of immigration reform and human rights, Rubio brokered a deal to send 250 Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador's brutal CECOP prison, where inmates have reported torture. Some former colleagues are appalled by the shift. Rubio's MAGA brain transplant is complete, said Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat Maryland. But some lawmakers and diplomats insist that behind the scenes, Rubio acts as a restraining force. Is there evidence to that? Of that? Rubio intervened on Ukraine's behalf last November when the White House envoy, Steve Witkoff, was pushing a ceasefire deal that Rubio reportedly condemned as a Kremlin wish list. After Rubio inserted himself into the U.S.-Ukrainian negotiations, the deal was revised to account for Ukraine's red lines. And when Trump threatened to grab Greenland from Denmark this year, Rubio quietly reassured European leaders. He's doing his best to moderate Trump's worst impulses, a European foreign minister told The New Yorker. But in other instances, he's fueled Trump's aggression, pushing for the removal of the Venezuelan strongman Maduro, whom he long denounced as a narco-dictator, and for almost total embargo of Cuba, the stunning 10 out of 10 success of the Maduro capture lifted his capital with Trump, said University of Florida foreign policy professor Patrick Hume, and boosted Trump's confidence in his ability to impose his will abroad. You could draw a direct line from Maduro raid to the Iran attack. And what does Rubio's future hold? Another White House bid is near certain, said observers. The question is, when? Vice President J.D. Vance is MAGA's heir apparent, and he dominates Rubio in the early 2028 polling. The Secretary of State has pledged to back Vance if he runs, and associates say he might hold his fire for a later run. But ABC News recently reported that a group of Republican donors is quietly exploring ways to boost him as a 2028 contender, and Trump has repeatedly floated Rubio as a possible successor. He has been privately polling advisors and friends about the relative merits of Vance and Rubio, according to media reports showing increasing fondness for 25 donors at Mar-a-Lago. He asked the crowd whom they wanted, Vance or Rubio. The verdict, one attendee told NBC News, was almost unanimous for Marco. And also from the week, in their column, It Must Be True, I read it in the tabloids. A customer perusing shelves of stuffed animals in an airport gift shop in Tasmania got a shock when she saw one creature's big brown eyes moving. The customer realized it was a live possum hiding amid stuffed dingoes and kangaroos and Tasmanian devils and reported it to a disbelieving clerk. Airport retail manager Leanne Bloomfield speculated that the possum saw all the stuffed animals and wanted to blend in. Airport staff removed it unharmed. And then you have a commonly blonde army soldier photographed with President Trump has become a MAGA dream girl. With more than a million Instagram followers, but she's an A1 generated fake. Jessica Foster has been depicted in more than 50 fake photos and videos, walking a tarmac with Trump, beaming next to an F-22 fighter jet, and meeting with Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. But the army confirms there is no such soldier. She's the epithesis of what MAGA fantasizes about, all packed into one channel, and said deepfakes researcher Sam Gregory. And a 15-year-old boy in Wiesbaden, Germany, stole a bus and used it to drive his 14-year-old girlfriend to school, 80 miles away. This teen had sneaked into the bus depot and used a master key to start the bus and drive off. The bus's GPS was later used to track it to the city of Karlsruhe, and police pulled it over and were shocked to find the teen behind the wheel. We do not yet know how he obtained the key and why he was able to drive the bus so well, a police spokesperson said. Also from the week, Mueller. Why Trump celebrated his death. Even by President Trump's low standards, said Jonathan Lemire in The Atlantic, cheering the death of another man is abhorrent. Last week, immediately after news broke that former FBI chief and Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller had died, Trump posted on Truth Social, "Good, I'm glad he's dead. He can no longer hurt innocent people." Mueller actually personified the values of honor and service, said Barbara McQuaid of MS Now. A lifelong Republican, Mueller joined the Marines after graduating Princeton and volunteered to serve in Vietnam, where he was awarded a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. For Trump to slander a war hero is particularly ugly, given the phony bone spurs he cited to escape the war. But it's also part of his unrelenting and very personal campaign to rewrite history, including his falsehood that Mueller's 2019 report on Russian election interference totally exonerated him. Russia's interference in the 2016 election was no hoax, said Kathy Young in the Bulkwood. Mueller's two-year investigation concluded that the Russian military launched a concerted attack on our political system and identified more than 140 contacts between Russia's Russians and Trump's inner circle, including campaign manager Paul Manafort, who shared polling data with the Russian intelligence officer. Russians hacked Democratic emails that WikiLeaks then released after coordinating with Trump ally Roger Stone. And Trump repeatedly and gleefully tooted that WikiLeaks disclosures on the campaign trail to hurt his opponent, Hillary Clinton, Mueller ultimately concluded he could not meet the high threshold required to prove criminal conspiracy, namely an explicit deal between Trump and Russia, but stated that the evidence does not exonerate the president. Indeed, Mueller said Trump had engaged in 10 possible acts of obstruction of justice that could be prosecuted after he left office. Excuse me. Mueller was once respected beyond reproach by both parties, said Garrett M. McGrath in his newsletter. In 2011, the Senate reconfirmed Mueller as the FBI director, 100-0. But this most institutional and institutionalist did not anticipate that his incredibly damning report would be distorted by Trump's partisan Attorney General William Barr, who released a misleading summary suggesting it had declared Trump nor did he expect Republicans to pretend it was all a hoax. Now, Mueller's era is over, and principled public servants like him are a literally disappearing breed in Washington. And what's new in tech? Supermicro's co-founder arrested. Three men with ties to Supermicro Computer, including a senior vice president, were charged last week with conspiring to smuggle AI technology to China, said Larry Neumeister and Michael Lipnick in the Associated Press. One of the men arrested was Yishun Wali Liao, one of the co-founders of the California-based company, which makes AI servers. Authorities say Lior and Ria Tsang Chang, a sales manager with the company, who remains a fugitive, directed executives of a company in Southeast Asia to place orders for $2.5 billion worth of servers that were passed on to China. The men went to great lengths to conceal their illegal exports, using fabricated documents and bogus equipment to pass audit inventories, officials say. Hair dryers were even used to remove labels and serial numbers from the servers that were swapped for dummy machines to avoid detection. And China is racing towards a commercialization of brain implants, said George Garay in Wired. Last week, it became the first nation to approve the commercial sale of a brain chip for people ages 19 to 60 with paralysis caused by neck or spinal cord injuries. The chip, called Neo, was developed by Neuracle Medical Technology and can reportedly translate the thoughts and intentions of a paralyzed person into movements of an assistive robotic hand. The Neo is different from other devices being tested clinically, such as Elon Musk's Neuralink, which consists of a recording chip and electrodes inserted into the brain. The coin-sized Neo is embedded into the skull with 8 electrodes that record electrical activity from the brain and send it wirelessly to a computer. And Tesla may be trimming its electric car lineup, but this summer it is planning to begin mass producing its first battery-powered semi-truck, said Paul Berger in the Wall Street Journal. The Tesla Semi is already a hit among truckers. They have tried it, and PepsiCo is one of the first companies to sign on for the long haul. Tesla said the new trucks can travel 500 miles on a single charge and also cost about $100,000 less than other battery electric trucks. One unique feature is that the steering wheel is positioned in the center of the cab, which drivers say helps eliminate the right side blind spot. Screens on either side of the wheel also show every object around the vehicle. Tesla is expected to deliver between 5,000 and 15,000 semis in 2026 before ramping up to 50,000 trucks a year. And cactus smugglers. Caterpillars are stealing succulents from threatened habitats in Mexico to raise them in U.S. nurseries, said Charlie McCann in 1843. Is this preservation or profiteering? There are plants, and then there are plants that make you sink to your knees and weep. Rand Fowler was on the hunt for a second kind, specifically a fine example of a rare succulent called Aguayshawi. Fowler had first encountered the specimen in 2023. Oops. On a plant hunting expedition in the Mexican desert. He was blown away by the beauty of its spines. Normally they are evenly spaced along the edge of the leaf, but on this plant they are fused, creating a ragged fringe that looked as if it had been dyed purple and pink. Fowler, who owns a succulent nursery in Southern California, knew it was risky to take a cutting from the aguay. Mexico restricts the export of many succulents, and it's illegal to take plants into America without declaring them. If border officials caught him, he could be sent to prison, but Fowler couldn't help himself. The mother plant was surrounded by baby plants, known as offsets or pups. He wrested one from the ground and carried it back to his car. 2 years later, the cutting was thriving, but Fowler wanted more. In April of 2025, he returned to Mexico, hoping to find the extraordinary aguave again. Traveling with him were two fellow caterpillars, Billy, who also ran a succulent nursery, and Chris, who described himself as just a backyard hobbyist, but a fully addicted one. And the names of all three men are pseudonyms. I grabbed a seat in Fowler's Toyota SUV, curious to understand how succulents can stoke such a passion. We set off from his home while it was still dark and paused at a gas station to stock up on chips and burritos. This was to be breakfast and lunch. Fowler doesn't waste time stopping for meals on his cactus expeditions. As dawn broke, a Grateful Dead album played quietly in the background, and the men gossiped about fellow succulent lovers who had run-ins with Mexican cartels. Fowler was a tanned, rangy surfer dude in his 50s who wore a knitted beanie from under which blonde hair poked out like straw. On desert tracks, he preferred to wear escuadrilles, and his ankles were covered in scratches. Hunting for rare plants in the wilds of Mexico is like being an old-time discoverer, he told me. When he finally finds what he is looking for, sometimes after days or weeks of searching, it gives me this high, he said. It makes me feel alive. After a couple of hours, we crossed into Baja California. The men craned their necks out of the car windows in search of their quarry. At one point, Billy cried out when he spotted some bright clusters spangling the coastal cliffs. Dulegia Brittoni, type of a succulent whose pale leaves gleam like shards of ice in the early morning light. After turning off the highway, we drove through fields of Carpobutus edulis, a low-lying succulent with purple leaves. Eventually, we approached a deep slope covered in rocks. Excuse me. The agua, Fowler said, was just beyond this escarpment. We got out and walked across the sandy brush, past bushes of wild lilac and clusters of Dahlia aratentiata, a fat-fingered succulent. Then Fowler spotted a clump of aguas, whose long stalks were waving in the wind. As the men crouched down to inspect them, I heard a whuh. The trio circled the clump, which was actually two plants surrounded by offsets. They inspected it from different angles, taking pictures and filming it with their phones. This is the supermodel here, purred Fowler. It did not look like a supermodel to me. Cultivated aguas are the hedgehogs of the plant world. Long pointy leaves emanate from the center, making them round and bristly. On the plants we were looking at, decades worth of dead leaves had accumulated, causing them to bend over. Their bodies were crowned with new growth that curved up toward the sun. Fowler pointed out the fused spines. This mutation is extremely unique, something you just don't see in this species, he explained. Fowler decided to take another offset for insurance. The clone he already had appeared to be doing well, but he didn't want to take any chances. Succulents transplanted from the wild often die because they have adapted to a microclimate that is difficult to create in a greenhouse. Fowler crouched down over the pup, the size and the shape of a large artichoke, and began to pull it out of the ground with his bare hands. The spines pierced his skin. It happens all the time, he said casually, blood trickling down his hands. After struggling for several minutes, he severed the plant from its roots and held it triumphantly aloft. I feel like I have to justify taking it, Fowler said as we headed back to the car. He explained that the agua was at risk of destruction from farmers clearing the brush from unscrupulous collectors. Once he got back to California, he would propagate his kite cuttings and sell the descendants in a few years. He hoped that this would make it less likely that poachers would take the mother, whose picture was already all over the internet, and sell her along with all her offsets for a fast buck. Fowler felt that he was different from these poachers. He had taken only two offsets out of many, and his motivations were more profound. He wanted the agua to live forever through its descendants. In his eyes, he was leading a rescue mission, an underground railroad for succulents. For as long as people have collected plants, they have stolen them. In the 1870s, the Royal Botanic Gardens in London paid an explorer $945 to steal rubber tree seeds from Brazil. The British East India Company commissioned a botanist to smuggle tea plants out of China. Attitudes began to change in the 1960s and 70s when the environmental movement popularized the idea that human activity was putting nature in peril. In 1973, 21 countries signed up to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, a treaty designed to protect all forms of wildlife from aguaves to zebras, 185 countries, but have now ratified it. But despite these efforts, succulents are in mortal danger, according to a study published in Nature in 2015. One in three species of cacti is threatened with extinction, a higher share than for birds or mammals. The main reason for this is the destruction of habitats for farming or housing. But they are also at risk from poaching as criminals attempt to profit from the increased demand for succulents. Easy care for and highly Instagrammable, succulents have swelled in popularity over the past decade. In 2024, the global succulent market was worth nearly $6 billion. That figure will more than triple by 2032. Predictions One Market Report predicts One Market Report. It is hard to estimate the size of the illegal market, although the scale of police seizures gives us a sense. For instance, in South Africa, the authorities seized 1.6 million illegally harvested succulents between 2019 and 2024. Some species sell for tens of thousands of dollars. In 2020, an Italian police seized over 1,000 rare Chilean cacti worth $1.2 million on the black market. International law enforcement had responded to this with a shrug. Prosecution for plant smuggling were rare, but the audacity and the scale of the poaching has forced American authorities to take action. In 2021, California introduced strong penalties for poaching Dublia. The following year, a Korean man who stole more than 3,700 Dublia Pharamosa from state parks in California and exported them to South Korea was sentenced to 2 years in prison. 3 years earlier, an American man convicted of stealing more than 500 cacti from the state park in Arizona was also sent to prison for 2 years. Some collectors, including Fowler, claim that they are saving species by snatching them from the wild. They take seed and cuttings from endangered species, propagate them, and give them their descendants to botanical gardens or sell them to hobbyists. Proponents of this form of vigilante conservation, at least one has dubbed himself the Indiana Jones of plants, argue that breaking laws meant to protect plants is sometimes necessary because those laws can actually get in the way of conservation. When they defend the unorthodox methods, ethical poachers often bring up a story of Mimalaria betharholdi, a little cactus with spines resembling false eyelashes that grows only in a small batch of Oxycan Hills. After it was discovered in 2013, it became highly prized among collectors, with some specimens reporting selling for over $1,000 a plant. Yet, within a few years, the price plummeted to $25. In his book, The Cactus Hunters, about the illegal trade in succulents, Jared D. Margulies writes that a band of Czech collectors told him they were responsible. They had smuggled M. betharholdi plants and seeds out of Mexico, propagated the species, and supplied the market with cultivated specimens, causing the price to crash. The group claimed their intervention had stopped the cactus from going extinct by deterring others from digging it up. And also from the week is the editor's letter. In this era of extreme polarization, there's one hero Americans of every political persuasion can get behind: Afro Man. The rapper, born Joseph E. Foreman, was a one-hit wonder back in 2000 with the jointy Because I Got High, in which he rattles off all the responsible things he would have done had he not smoked that blunt. We didn't hear much else from him until last week, when he prevailed in court over the police officers suing him for defamation. Sheriff's deputies had smashed in the front door of his Ohio home in 2022 with a warrant to look for drugs and supposed kidnapping victims. Guns drawn, they terrorized his wife and children. He wasn't home as they ransacked the house. When they found nothing, Afroman retaliated with the only weapon available to him, his AK. In using footage from his wife's cell phone and his home security system, as well as what looked like a few stills from officers' Facebook pages, he put on a series of music videos lampooning the deputies. The police raid, why you're disconnecting my video camera, and will you help me repair my door? Speak for themselves, but it was lemon pound cake that really bugged the cops. Set to the tune of Under the Boardwalk, the video shows one of the deputies in Afroman's kitchen as he pauses to look at a cake sitting enticingly on the counter in a glass dome cake stand. That officer bears the brunt of the mockery. He's hungry and he's big as hell. Though the lone female officer is also singled out, a racist feminist. Seven deputies sued, saying they suffered public ridicule because of the videos, and that Afroman's fans had sent hundreds of pounds of cakes to the Adams County Sheriff's Office. But a judge threw out most of the claims, while a jury, having watched Afroman testify in an American flag suit, rejected the rest. Pundits from Mother Jones to Fox News cheered as well as they should. This is still a free country. When state agents use the power of the law to invade your home, you have a First Amendment right that make them go viral. I didn't win, Afroman said. America won. And Bill Mayer was lined up to receive this year's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, The Atlantic reported last week, only to have the prize yanked away by the White House. Shortly after the outlet reported the Kennedy Center's Honors Committee had selected, but not yet announced, the late-night host as the recipient, the White House Press Secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, called the story fake news, adding, Bill Mayer will not be getting this award. Mayer and Trump have had a rocky relationship. Trump briefly sued Mayer in 2013 for suggesting his father was an orangutan. But in early 2025, he invited the comedian to dinner at the White House, and Mayer called Trump gracious. By last month, Trump had again soured on Mayer, griping that the real-time host was criticizing him on air and that it was a waste of time for me to have this jerk in the White House. Also from the week, why universal health care isn't viable. Medicare for All is back, said Ramesh Ponnuru, and it's still a completely impractical idea. Several Democratic Senate candidates and gubernatorial candidates are reviving the proposal to have the federal government administer a national health care program for every American. Democrats have never generated much support for universal health care and won't have an easier time selling it now. Proponents admit national health care would cost upwards of $1 trillion a year and require major tax increases on the middle class. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders argues that savings on insurance premiums and deductibles would cancel out higher taxes, but voters won't trust that promise. Countries with national health care systems pay doctors and hospitals far less than they are paid in the U.S., and care is rationed with waiting times of months. Is any of that politically feasible in the U.S.? National health care would also require kicking more than 200 million Americans off employer-provided insurance and individually purchased policies. Would most Americans willingly give up their existing coverage for a new government-run system of unknown cost and quality. Democrats are on the verge of learning again. That answer is no way. A new void in vaccine guidance. The U.S. no longer has an official vaccine policy, said Catherine J. Wu. A federal judge last week ruled that the Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. likely broke federal law when he fired and replaced all 17 members of the CDC's expert vaccine advisory panel with fellow anti-vaxxers. In the ruling, the judge also invalidated all of that panel's new policies on childhood vaccines and other preventive shots, saying its arbitrary and capricious decisions were not based in solid science. The Trump administration indicated it would appeal, but a legal battle will leave vaccine policy in a kind of purgatory for months or longer. The nation has never been so suddenly stripped of its vaccine advisors. With no backup plan, it's unclear now that the CDC will make recommendations on annually updated vaccines for flu and COVID, or on any new vaccines. Medical groups and most doctors in Democrat states, health officials all continue to strongly recommend childhood and other vaccines. Polls show that Kennedy has deepened vaccine doubts and fears, especially among Republicans. Americans, in effect, have been left with all too many options for whom to listen to about vaccines.